conference. Thank you for inviting me. Love Canada. Why do I love Canada? My people fled Europe in the latter part of the 19th century for the reason that a lot of us are here. A lot of us had that problem. They came to Wyoming and had the same problem, lawlessness. In Canada, it was not a problem because the Canadians sent the mounted police out ahead of the settlers and didn't end up with the same no law west of the Pecos syndrome. So what I'd like to talk to you about today is no law west of thermodynamics, and in particular, the ways in which what you know very well goes contrary to what people who think they know thermodynamics believe. So a lot of this comes back to a very vigorous argument which Herbert Walter Yakeer and I had many years ago when I told Yakeer that we were looking for lasing without inversion. How do you do that? Well, you cancel absorption, but you keep emission. And he said, but doesn't that break detailed balance? And I said, well, I never thought about it. He said, well, you can't break detailed balance. And so I thought about it, and I said, oh, yeah, I can. It's only in thermodynamic equilibrium that it involves a second law. So we had nice arguments, really excellent arguments, and it started me off on this whole business of applying tricky, not necessarily entanglement, coherence is enough, quantum mechanics to thermodynamics. And a decade ago, I was teaching thermodynamics at Princeton, and I wanted to show them something new and show them why I think thermodynamics is a super subject. So let me start off today by reminding you that quantum mechanics comes from thermodynamics, not from some sort of photoelectric effect, as we often think that Einstein was the road that Einstein used to get the photon concept. No, he got the photon concept by studying entropy of light. So I'm praising this crazy guy, Aharonov, for stimulating me to talk about, think about, spend a decade on the notion of breaking detailed balance. And this was our paper that we did after our discussion with Herbert Walter, you may remember. Great, excellent visit to Tel Aviv many, many years ago. Thank you. Now, what I want to do is tell you about the ways in which the concepts of quantum coherence are useful and counterintuitive from a thermodynamic point of view, and actually potentially something beyond what you would expect from a biophysics point of view. It turns out that quantum mechanical coherence effects are found these days in biological systems, in studying photodetection, in studying the conversion of light to ATP in a reaction center. So I won't get through this whole talk, that's okay. But if I can convince you at least of the fact that there's something interesting here and get you to weigh in on the side of truth and wisdom to the arguments that are going on, maybe I can get some of the Canadian intellectual mounted police working on this problem. There are lots and lots of fascinating topics here, and I want to show them to you. And I'm going to go fast. Down here off the edge of the board is the application to photosynthesis. So that's probably appropriate. I probably won't get there. But let's just go through this business and do a good job on what we do. Now, I started at about a quarter after.
Running 15 minutes later.
So I'm destined to quit when the big hand's on the 12,
yeah,
right?
Last 5 minutes for questions. So
you got it. So you, and questions at any time, please. I appreciate questions. I was at a seminar at Los Alamos many years ago, and Edward Teller was talking. And he said, I always like questions. If you have a question, somebody else probably has the same question. So ask it. So somebody asked a question. Keller said, that's the first stupid question of the seminar. No more question. So heat engines.
Why did you ever talk with Edward Teller?
Why did I ever talk with Edward Teller? Good question. Well, at the time, he was a fascinating guy working in the arena of X-ray lasers. I'm a laser nick, okay? You should all learn a trade, young people, so that you'll be able to succeed and get jobs, okay? I loved quantum mechanics and statistical mechanics, but I can always get a job because I know about lasers. Teller thought that they had detonated an atomic bomb downhole in Nevada and made an X-ray laser, and he was wrong. So he was at Livermore, and we at Los Alamos, I was a consultant to Los Alamos for many years, were shooting him down. That's why I was.
You got away with him.
Good. But Teller was not a bad guy. And you might like to know some more about Teller someday. What I'd like to emphasize here is that there are aspects of quantum mechanics within the context of ordinary heat engines, or perhaps extraordinary heat engines. So a classical heat engine operates from a high temperature energy source, extracting energy and throwing away energy to a low temperature entropy sink. I'm going to tell you about a Fodor-Carnot engine, which is based on breaking detailed balance, which is based on the fact that we've proven we can make lasers without inversion, and show you how this system can extract energy from a single thermal reservoir and not violate the second law. And finally, going on to lasers and photocells, photosynthesis as far as we get. So let's not spend too much time on the history, except to note that what Planck did was to look at the entropy of light. He didn't study statistical mechanics and show something about the partition function, as we often teach our students, but he was looking at the entropy of light, and that's how he got the Planck distribution. Einstein, he came to wave-particle duality by studying the entropy of a beam of thermal light. And he found that there was, under some conditions, a wave-like and a particle-like contribution to the entropy. The photoelectric effect, it's at the end of the paper. A simple throwaway paragraph saying, and as far as I can tell, says Einstein, this doesn't violate the photoelectric effect. Let's now turn to this idea of the Carnot, Fodor-Carnot engine, and remind ourselves of what we all know, that the great physicist Carnot, who was an officer in Napoleon's army, was studying ways in which France could have an advantage over England. And he made the statement that if you take the steam engine away from England, you will do more harm than if you take her navies away. And so how about we figure out a way to make a better steam engine? So this had really put France into the position of strength, right? Well, in so doing, he came up with this beautiful concept of the maximum efficiency that you can get, because in those days, you know, 1802, the engines were very inefficient, 1% efficient, burning coal to pumping water out of a well or some such. And Carnot said, well, what if I burn alcohol? Or what if I make a different kind of engine? And he showed in ways that we now understand using the concept of entropy, which he, of course, didn't use. That was Clausius 50 years later. But Carnot said, doesn't matter what you do. Doesn't matter what kind of engine you build. You will always find that the efficiency is given by the temperature of the stuff you're burning and the water or the cooling tower that you're using to operate in a closed cycle. And it's always nice to think about this from the point of view of an isothermal expansion path, and then an adiabatic expansion path, and then, so that's work. From 1 to 2, 2 to 3 is work. And then you have to do waste work, but you want to do that when the steam is at a lower temperature, thus the low temperature entropy sink. So it's that difference between the useful work and the waste work that constitutes thermodynamic efficiency. So now let's think about this simple engine. What if we had a simple system? One normal mode, one monochromatic standing wave, and we power, or which could of course then produce pressure on the surface. And that pressure, if it's a single atom, the pressure is PV equals KT, K Boltzmann's constant times T. If it's a photon single mode, then it's PV equals H bar times the frequency of the mode in question times the average number of thermal photons. So one atom, PV, Boltzmann's constant, times T. If I have a gas of atoms, I of course put N here, but I don't want to do that. Now one mode, not one photon, but one mode, okay, PV equals, it's not hard to show, and it's discussed somewhat in this science article, something I hadn't seen before, H bar, energy per photon, times the number of photons. But remember, and we'll come back to this over and over again, the average number of photons, Planck's factor, 1 over e to the, okay, 1 over e to the h bar omega over kT minus 1. You expand this for high temperatures, and this goes to kT over h bar omega. So in the limit of high temperatures, these two are the same. Therefore, if I can make a simple engine of this type, in which I have, say, two level atoms, and I circulate them through a whole round at temperature T hot, they come to thermodynamic equilibrium with the radiation. And I then take them over here, drop them through my single mode oscillator, my maze or laser, if you will, and I can do useful work. I can operate this piston on a isotherm in which I'm dropping the atoms through fast enough that I keep the temperature constant, keep the average number of photons constant. And there are subtleties, but let's not get into those. I can then go with the adiabatic by shutting off the atomic beam and just letting things coast. And then finally, I just have an ordinary low temperature entropy sink. I do the calculation in any number of ways. It's fun to do it. And I always get Carnot, just what Carnot taught us. I don't care if you use photons or atoms or neutrinos. I don't care if it's a nuclear accelerator or a lawnmower. I'm always going to get the same efficiency. So the single atom, single mode physics is what's going on here. And I'll keep that here because I want to refer to it. But now let's show, let's convince ourselves that this device, this photo-Carnot engine, has an efficiency which is greater than Carnot efficiency, and let's also explain why that does not violate the second law, even though some statements of the second law would be violated and are violated by this result. So start with two level atoms, okay? In particular then, the average number of thermal photons is governed by a simple equation. Alpha is the rate at which atoms fall through times matrix elements squared, coupling the atom to the field, times the time it takes to fall through. So that's alpha, it's nothing interesting. But the probability that the atom is in the excited state, I'll always try to use this same notation, that the lasing in our physics is going between levels A and B, so the probability of being in the excited state is given by the diagonal elements of the density matrix rho AA, and the ground state is rho BB. Okay, if I'm in the excited state, I can have stimulated emission, that's Einstein, 1912, and I have spontaneous emission plus one. Now this looks different than the Einstein A and B coefficient because I've only got one mode, but that's the physics. And then I have absorption. I'm extracting energy from the field according to stimulated absorption. And I can solve that in steady state in just a couple of quick lines, and I find the Planck distribution as a consequence of the fact that the Boltzmann factors govern the populations in the excited state and indeed all states. So I've got our favorite n bar result, Planck, and at the high temperature limit, I've got the fact that the number of thermal photons goes like kT, the thermal energy, divided by the energy per photon. Fair enough. Now, let me step aside and remind myself in your presence about lasing without inversion. Now, something wrong with this view graph, sorry, is that I labeled things a little wrong. Capital A sub alpha, it should be a C here, C, because I'm pulling in probability from the C state up to A and from the B state up to A. So if I ask what's the probability, put an atom in, and I look at the chances I absorbed a photon, it goes like these two probability amplitudes, out of the C state and out of the B state, square. Conversely, interestingly, for the probability of emission, I'm going from the A state down to B and down to C. So I add probabilities in this case. So that's A sub C squared plus B sub B squared. Now I can have lasing without inversion, even though I may have a much larger population in the states B and C, because I can cancel, and I do in the lab, cancel this absorption. That's the idea. And it turns out then that if we do simple experiments along these lines, along rubidium 87, we have a couple of levels down here. We create a coherence between these levels, and we do that in this case by driving in a lambda configuration, but never mind the details. We create coherence, and when we have coherence, and only 10% of the atoms, say, in the excited state, 90% in a ground state complex, so now I've got two levels down here, and I'm going to say, okay, I've got 45% at each of these levels, but I cancel absorption, and that 10%, and that's literally what we had in those experiments, that 10% is all I see. And you can see the nice sharp green line. So this is the first experimental proof of lasing without inversion and demonstration of breaking of detailed bounds. Now let's go back and apply the same idea to our Photo Carnot engine. And we're saying this time, well, what if I can create a coherence between these two levels, B and C, and as I propagate through my whole realm, I also have microwaves at work which generate this coherence. Nobody can stop me from that. I now go through, I drop through the engine, and I ask, what's the efficiency of extracting energy from this high temperature reservoir and dumping energy into the low temperature entropy sink. Okay, so that's the idea. And the way to see this very simply is just to once again write down a rate equation for the number of photons. And I won't bore you with the details, but I will emphasize that whereas in the previous view graph, which had only two levels, and that's back here, you see I had something coming in which is a cross product between B and A. B, A star, that's the off-diagonal elements of the density matrix. Rho AB plus complex conjugate. If I multiply that by a matrix element between A and B, that's equal to the dipole moment per atom. And so it's that kind of physics that's going on here. I have not only the ground state probabilities, but I have the dipole matrix elements. See, it's not AB, but BC. Fair enough. So now do it again. Calculate for me the steady state number of thermal photons. Run through the calculation. You'll find very quickly that it's just what we had before, KT over H bar, times a factor, a ubiquitous factor, which turns out to be the number of thermal photons in the reservoir times this coherence ratio. The ratio of the coherence, maximal value of a half, the ratio of the excited state probability amplitude, or whatever, maximum of one between zero and one.
Could I ask a question? Maybe it's one of the stupid ones. I'm not so sure you were talking about a temperature of the atomic system, but now there's also coherence.
Good.
How does that
Good.
Work?
Thank you. Good man. So my friend says, yeah, but do you really have temperature anymore? Because now you've got rho AA, rho BB, and rho CC, and now you're throwing in rho BC and rho CB. And is it the case that somehow these probabilities are changing enough that the rho BC doesn't matter, it's the Boltzmann factors that matter? Turns out that I can have a very tiny change here, like a part in 10 to the 2, part in 10 to the 4, but over here, the corresponding piece will turn out to be a part in 10 to the 8, okay? So that it is a very tiny change of probability, but a very large change in the off-diagonal elements. And furthermore, the amount of energy that it takes to create this coherence is something you gotta really keep in your mind. Good question. That's the first good question of the seminar. So, do the calculation. Let's see, I don't think I emphasized that the phase of the microwave is coming into the game. So we have something we might call a temperature T phi. So this is fun. Nobody's going to really argue with it very much, except for questions like this. You put them to rest, and pretty soon you see that the temperature T phi then can be cast back in terms of the temperature T hot and T cold in such a way as to convince you that if we're operating with a phase phi equals pi, I can now violate the Carnot rule. Violate's not quite the right word. Extend is a better word. And that I can even get useful work if the temperature T hot equals T cold. Okay, so right away you say to yourself, well, so what? Is that interesting? It is in the following sense. Suppose that you say, well, I could always increase the efficiency just by heating up the engine a little bit. I've got a jet, and I want to increase the power of my jet for a short time because I'm being pursued. So I'll just put in super fuel. But what if I'm already operating at the materials limit such that putting in a little bit more heat melts the engine? I'm out of luck. Ah, putting in this kind of fuel doesn't constitute putting in heat, so I can get a little boost, but it costs me something. I've got to actually work. I've got to actually do work, microwave work, to produce this extra little bit. But I can think of that as something that I did back at the refinery. I made this extra fuel, extra hot, high-grade fuel, and I'm now putting through atoms in my engine with this kind of characteristic. So that's interesting, and in fact, it may be that nature has discovered this, and maybe nature says that an amoeba can swim at a certain speed, which, by the way, is faster than a leopard. If you take the time that it takes for an amoeba to go 10 body lengths, he's moving faster than a leopard. But maybe I could go a little faster if I had quantum coherence working for me, and indeed that's the case. What do you mean that's the case? I mean, if I go back now and apply all this to biology at the level of photosynthesis, I can increase the efficiency of photosynthesis. In principle, that's the case. Never mind amoeba, I haven't worked on amoeba. I find photosynthesis hard enough. All right, so that's the end of that story. We've done something which we will get a lot of hate mail on, and we did, but finally we got friends, and turns out that most everybody agrees, yes, that's true. But now let's look at another example in which the kind of physics that we're thinking about comes into focus, and that's the laser as a quantum heat engine, first suggested by Schultz Dubois, a physicist in Switzerland, at Lucerne, and gentleman Scoville, I never had the pleasure to meet. But these two bright guys said, think of the laser this way. Here's a new point of view. What if I can put atoms into a cavity, and I've got levels A and B, and what if I have thermal light, like solar radiation, at some temperature, T hot or T solar? And where T solar is, of course, defined by the Boltzmann factor made Planckian, H bar omega between A and B over KT solar minus 1. So if I start off with all the atoms in the ground state, and I heat the system up, well, now I can put half the atoms upstairs, but only half. That's all I can do, right? And so I can never create population inversion with just thermal light. Yes, and that's why we make three-level lasers, nothing to do with coherence. Move a long way away. These coherent doublets are always microwave distances apart, typically. So we move a long ways away, we have a ground state, and now we not only send in hot light, T hot, or T solar, we also send in cold light. And what that does is it sucks the population out of B and puts it downstairs. Okay, so we end up, say, with something like that. Now we have population inversion, and that's what Schultz Dubois were talking about. And in particular, they say, consider the ratio of the population in the B and the A state, and divide by, here we're calling it G, the ground state amplitude probability, which is a Boltzmann factor, in this case and this case. So we end up noting that nu sub solar is equal to omega AB, and nu sub cold is equal to omega, the frequency of the atom between B and C, right? So that omega AB is the energy in the excited state minus the energy in the ground state over H bar, and that's equal to nu hot or nu solar. Fair enough. So I'm now going to put in, for this term, a Boltzmann factor, e to the minus alpha up. This term is a Boltzmann factor upside down, so it's plus. And now I can talk about, for example, the situation at threshold in which this has to equal 1. NB equals NA at threshold. So these exponents are equal. Okay, so if these exponents are now equated, and you help me out, if I can get the same notation, nu cold over KT cold equals H bar nu hot or nu solar over KT hot. But now I'm going to replace this cold by nu hot minus nu laser. So now I just do one more step, and I get that the ratio of the energy per laser photon divided by the energy per hot photon is Carnot. Great result. So here, for the first time, I've never seen the Carnot factor coming up in ways that didn't involve the Carnot isothermal adiabatic argument. So I think this is kind of neat. And the students always love this. But now let's go further. And let's say, what if I now break this level into a doublet and do some sort of microwave-induced coherence? Do I get a payoff? Yes. Then I find that the ratio, the quantum efficiency, the quantum factor, gets an extra piece, and that piece is n bar kT over h nu, average number of thermal photons times rho bc. Again, great new result. Three things. First of all, please note that this is not a thermodynamic result at this stage. What I'm talking about is a quantum efficiency. I've not yet talked about power, okay? Secondly, this is the same enhancement factor that we got with the Photo-Carnot engine, right? Great. And so now I see that there may be something deeper in all this. And so let's just summarize where we are now. The Carnot efficiency is not necessarily an upper bound, and we're going to find that even the power out can be enhanced by using these quantum coherence effects. Boy, out of time. Okay, so now I'm teaching thermodynamics, and I figure, what should I teach? Well, let's teach them about photocells. So I pick up a good book, and I start reading about photocells. And I'm going to tell you a little about photocells. You probably have learned this at some time in your life, but you probably forgot that you put an NP junction together, and you shine light on it, and it creates a population imbalance between holes and electrons. And that gives a voltage here, because you've changed the effective Fermi surface, the chemical potential. And that's how a photocell works. But the losses are what we're all talking about. And there are three sources of loss that you want to keep in mind. First of all, you've got the loss associated with the fact that your spectrum of light incident will have lots of photons that don't have enough energy to promote you to the excited state first. Secondly, when you do have photons that are energetic enough to promote you from the valence band to the conduction band, you'll have some kind of thermal losses, this much. That's the second point. And you'll have other thermal losses, three, but there's yet one more loss, which is radiative recombination. Suppose that you understand all these. Now you've got some electron in the excited state, but before it can tunnel across and do useful work by powering a light bulb, you have radiative recombination. That's something that you always got to worry about. So let's not take the whole spectrum. Let's just take a slice, a tiny slice right here. So it's single mode. Let's also consider quantum dots working for us in the center so that I can tailor the level structure of my electrons as before. So I can make two levels down here or two levels upstairs in the conduction band. So here I'm talking about dividing the photon flux into different bins and then doing work with monochromatic light using these quantum dots in the intervening region between P and N, in the depletion region. So, okay, so now I start reading books on photocells. And this one excellent book by a physicist in Germany called The Physics of the Solar Cell talks about these processes, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then he says, and that leaves radiative recombination as the major loss. Now, I've got the electron where I want it, but before it does useful work, it decays, gives me back the photon. Can this be avoided? The answer is no. If a radiative upward transition is allowed, its reverse, radiative downward, must be allowed too. But we know how to break detail balance. And with an eye on the clock, I'm not going to take you through the arithmetic. This is in that PhysRev letter. And I will simply tell you that when you go back through, put two levels upstairs. Now this time, I'm not trying to cancel absorption. I want to cancel emission. Right? So I want these two processes to cancel. Perfectly possible. And when you do it, you get an enhanced efficiency. Before we were talking about the energy of the laser photon, H bar nu laser, divided by H bar nu solar. And now we find that it's the open circuit voltage, EV0, over H bar nu solar. And it takes a Saturday afternoon to get comfortable with these factors. But the fact is that we now can readdress this issue of radiative detailed balance. And we find that we can change the sentence that appears in that book that I like. The answer is yes. Radiative downward transitions can be mitigated by breaking detailed balance via quantum coherence. So there are, again, several things that I want to learn from this. I want to learn that, first of all, quantum coherence can do me some good, and somewhere up here I should say, I hope I do, that lasers and photocells are very close cousins when it comes to the physics and the mathematics. And with 3 minutes left, I'll tell you about an interesting way to think of this as perhaps being practical. If you put in microwaves all the time, and you find that you're doing more work to produce the coherence than what you actually are gaining from the system, that may or may not be interesting. But there's another way to get coherence, and that's by using noise-induced coherence. And Steve Harris at Stanford is the first guy who taught me this, but Girish Agarwal at Texas A&M is the first guy who really showed it. So in that PhysRev letter that I wrote, by the way we do physics in my group is we have group meetings every week. And so the new idea goes up, and I go as far as I can, and then the graduate students or postdocs take it up, and we meet next week and see how far we are. If we're at the same point, well, I've thought about it a week, I can go a little further. And if at the end of a couple months, the problem's all solved, and the students haven't gotten involved, then I have to write the damn paper, okay? So I had to write this doggone paper, and it was kind of fun. But the key point that I made was that quantum noise can induce coherence via phonal coupling. And now I can show you that several ways, but these papers have been published. And let me just tell it to you this way. Suppose you start off with population only in the excited state, A1, A2, B. And now you turn the system loose, interacts with the vacuum, you get radiation out. After a while, what do I expect? Well, I expect that this is going to go to a configuration which has all the atoms downstairs. That's spontaneous emission, but it doesn't. It goes under some conditions to this, 50% downstairs and 25% in each of these levels. Furthermore, this is a coherent superposition. Physically, I emit and then I reabsorb coming back. Virtual transitions over and over again. But frequently I go to the wrong level. And it's this emission reabsorption that can give you coherence. And with 1 minute left, I will tell you that if you now work out the power that you're getting out of this laser, you'll find that first do Schultz-Dubois problem, and now do it with coherence. And you get a factor of 2 increase in the power emitted. Now do the same thing for a photocell. It's a little harder. You have to think a little harder. But you get the same factor of 2. So the power out can, in principle, and we think in practice sometime, can, in principle, be increased by, 50%, or by a factor of 2. Maybe I'd call it 100%. If I'm in market sales, I'll call it 100%. Okay? So that's probably a good place to quit. But I remark that there is a paper in the literature with my colleagues here in which we show that these same ideas can be applied to photosynthesis. And that is the subject of vigorous debate in the literature at this point. So I'm hiring postdocs. And when you're ready, all of you smart guys are invited. Thank you for your attention.
Yes. A Mach-Zehnder interferometer can be thought of a two-state system. It's also the canonical device for making weak measurements. Have you ever thought about working out the thermodynamics for single photons going through the two states and seeing whether or not that gave you a different type of quantum efficiency in what approach you're doing?
Yes, I have. Very, very much so. Let me turn it around just slightly. So his point is an excellent point. He wants to think about the fact that a beam splitter going through a Mach-Zehnder interferometer has seemingly a little bit in common with this problem. It has more than a little bit in common. Here's the point. Suppose I have 2 beams of light. So these are fibers, fiber, and I put it into another fiber, okay? So this is light, which is T hot. And the number of photons now, n bar equals kT hot, and the classical limit over the energy per photon. Okay, so now I say, well, let this be a Mach-Zehnder interferometer on the one hand, and let it be this example on the other. So let me first concentrate here. Forget Mach-Zehnder for a second. So I go in. Now I've got 6 photons coming out. That's good news, because now I've got something hotter here than there. And so I can make a steam engine just by putting 2 beams together from the sun. I don't need a lower temperature reservoir. And you say, well, that must not work because it violates the second law. And in fact, it's true, it can't work. And this was a problem which people in fiber optics at Bell Labs argued about a lot. And they finally figured it out, and we called it a fiber optic illusion.
It's rather than metallurgy.
Sorry?
It's rather than metallurgy.
Fair enough. But now let's go back to his point and say, well, come on, I thought that I could put 2 beams of light into a beam splitter and get all the light, E1, E2, coming out here. Mach Zehnder, right? I come in, go like that. I come in, go like that. And I can get 100% of the light this way or that way, but it's not thermal light. It's pure zero entropy light. So between these two is somewhere physics that's a little like what we're doing. Good point.
One more question.
So sort of what prevents you from hooking up your super Carnot heat engine to a regular plain old Carnot heat pump and straight up violating, say, law of thermodynamics? Sort of what's the catch? Where's the kind of energy coming from? Because if you have, like, you know, the efficiency is kind of the boundary between the heat pump side and the heat engine side.
Right.
So how can you cross it?
So, see that? What's the catch? Where's the beef? Right? So it isn't at all that I'm generating extra energy. What people have tried to do over the years, over and over again, is to make a engine which is powered just by cooling off the atmosphere a little bit or cooling off the ocean a little bit and then run all the light that it takes to power the world. So I'm not making energy, I'm just extracting it in a very efficient and impossible way, okay? So that's what I'm doing here. I'm finding a way to make a sort of special thermal reservoir that allows me to take energy out more efficiently than I could if I didn't have this little bit of quantum coherence. So you can always say, well, big deal. You aren't doing thermodynamics. As soon as you put off-diagonal elements to the density matrix into the game, it's not thermal anymore. And that was the point that was made here. And when I say, yeah, you don't think it's a big deal? Well, I think it's a big deal. And furthermore, the NSF thinks it's a big deal. So, and it is, because if I go back now to this sort of physics, I can, in fact, find ways to probably get more efficient by 10 or 15% photosynthetic process.
Okay, so thanks a lot.